Save big on your Memorial Day barbecue, all in the Kroger app. Get 3-pound rolls of juicy 80% lean ground beef for $3.49 a pound with a digital coupon. Then get select varieties of flavorful Powerade, Body Armor Super Drink, or Arizona Tea for 77 cents each, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
They're all out. They're gone. They're doing different things. And yeah, and we're not, there's not a lot of combat going on anywhere right now. Maybe some advice and assist for some of the, you know, tier one forces, but that's it. So if something else happens, we've found a way to get rid of all our talent.
Let's go.
Welcome to Citizen. We got a special guest today, Andrew Sullivan from Community First. Before we get into the nonprofit, why don't you introduce yourself to the audience?
Yeah, I appreciate you having me here. Andrew Sullivan, everybody calls me Sully. I grew up in Massachusetts, and I guess to hit the wave tops right after 9/11, I decided I was going to join the Navy and try to become a SEAL. And got on the first bird to boot camp and made it through SEAL training and spent the next 2 decades of my life fighting wars overseas and trying to defend the country and make it safer for my family, my friends, and my communities. Retired in 2020 and started my own company, which led to me starting the nonprofit to provide free training to law enforcement. But I mean, those are the wave tops.
Yeah. Where did you, you said you grew up in Boston area?
Yeah, so I grew up in a town called Worcester, which is not too far from Boston. I maybe 35 miles as the crow flies, but yeah. I these days I tend to spend most of my time in Boston.
What are those? I guess you could say middle class cities around Boston, like, because I know Boston's can, you know, every major city can be kind of fucked up, but there's a lot of New England has a lot of like strangely. I guess I don't know if conservative is even the right word because it's not really a political thing. It's just kind of like a tougher. There's tougher groups around the periphery of Boston than there are in the city.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to get political, really, it's the city of Boston that kind of shapes the political leaning of the state. But if you get into all the communities around Boston, it's very blue collar and it's very generational. Which makes it super pro-military, pro-law enforcement, pro-public service. And the support that we get up there in the military and in the law enforcement side is really second to none. So definitely, I think a little bit of a culture shock for people that don't expect that because if they don't go there a lot, they just see what they see on TV. But it's a very supportive place to be, and I love traveling there.
Well, yeah, they see like I don't want to make this political, but there's so much retarded shit that happens in Boston. Like the mayor you have there is wild as hell, having segregated fucking office parties and shit like that. That's new. I mean, it's not new, I guess. It's just new for the North.
it's new, and obviously Massachusetts has always been left. But when you look at it, their left is really. Just center right nowadays. It's crazy because the left has gone so far, but yeah, Mary Wu came in and she ran on a platform of defunding police overtime and taking money away from cops and still won. And I think she realized really quickly that was probably not the right decision to do. It was going to cost her more money in the long run, but yeah, it's crazy that when you get people in power that have extreme views on both sides of the aisle.
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of goofy. To be honest, I don't get it. It's like the woke Olympics or something. I don't know. Like people, right? It's like people just trying to outdo each other. I sincerely don't understand it.
It's bizarre these days. Sometimes you just watch the news and you're like, what the fuck is going on? How is this even possible from a common sense perspective that this is happening? I just don't get it either.
Yeah, well,
strange world.
I'm not sure if it's even useful to try to figure it out. Instead of just like, because you wouldn't try to reason with a guy who is shitting in his hand and smeared it on the wall. You would just tell him to stop.
Yeah, right. Or I just get the fuck away.
Yeah, right. Yeah. But so let's get back into the Boston area.
yeah. Clearly, you're a Red Sox fan.
Well, you guys have never beaten us in the playoffs at least. If you were like a fucking Mets fan or something, maybe.
No.
I would laugh at you. And if you were a Phillies fan, I would be angry.
Yeah.
Yeah. No. So what was it like growing up there in Worcester?
It was great. And it's weird. I tell people I loved my childhood growing up there. I loved my community. I grew up in the same house that my mom grew up in and my grandfather built with his family. And all my neighbors were generational, so they were like extended family. That being said, I would never let my kids grow up there. It was a different life. And I don't think it has certainly changed quite a bit. Probably through my 20s and 30s, but it's actually gotten really nice again. It was much nicer again than it was, my college years. So that being said, I'm not doing winters either. I like being in the South and not shoveling snow so I can go to work. But it was a great upbringing. I grew up in the city. I played sports. I went to school so I could play sports. When I was with my friends, we played sports. Mm. That was my childhood. That's what I remember doing. And man, I loved it. I had a blast.
And then, did you go to college or do you go to, was it?
I did. I went to college in North Carolina, East Carolina University for a couple of years. Yeah. And then that didn't go well, but,
that's a party school, man. You can't, if you don't go in with intent there, you're not going to make it.
100%. I had no intent. I had no idea what I wanted to do. I went there just for the college experience. And
well, you're going
to
get one there.
Oh, I got one. I got enough for a couple people, actually. So probably not the best decision in hindsight, but I ended up at Worcester State for a little while, and then I ended up in the D.C. area, and that's where I was for 9/11. I didn't finish going back to school until I was an adult.
Sure, yeah.
My undergrad and my master's.
Was there any thought given to joining the military before 9/11, or was that like a true impetus moment for you?
No, there was. I had always had that in my head that I wanted to do something like that. And I really, it's just such a big decision, especially to go into, I didn't want to be in the military. I wanted to be in the SEALs, right? I didn't want to go and fail or get hurt, whatever might happen. And that hesitation just kept me from joining. And really what 9/11 for me was just a straw that broke the camel's back. And it was like, all right, stop fucking around. We're doing this. We have to. It was an obligation at that point for me. I knew that I had to do something to help fix this problem and where else but front lines. And I felt like buds and being a SEAL got me close to the fight and in the fight. And that's where I wanted to be. So.
Yeah. Yeah. And you spent quite a bit of time on the frontest of lines.
I did.
And then, you know, it's like, I was an infantry man in the 82nd Airborne, so you know we just go out and fuck shit up. It's like the, it's
you got it.
I think it's way more kinetic than it is intellectual with our pursuit. You know what I mean?
It's
just a bunch of rabid knuckleheads going crazy
and point shit. And shoot, right?
Yeah, but you know, even at our level, it became clear pretty quickly that at least in Iraq, I only went to Iraq. I don't know about Afghanistan, but in Iraq, it was like, what the fuck is this? What are we doing here? Exactly. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
We're like trying to be police in a war zone that we created. I don't know how this is going to work out. You know, so I think that that instinct to try to go solve that problem, that's definitely a masculine and patriotic instinct to have, because I experience it myself. I wonder from your perspective as things went on, you know what I mean, because you were in for a while, but right from the beginning, you know what I mean, as things evolved, was there a point during that period where you're like, oh man, this is fucking stupid, you know?
Yeah, that's my first two deployments were Iraq, and honestly we didn't do much anything. My first deployment we did PSD, so personal security, for the top five Iraqis, so president, two vice presidents, prime minister, and a foreign prime minister.
This is before Blackwater came in and took over all those DSS contracts.
Yeah, and I don't think Blackwater took those over. It was I think we turned it off to a South African company, to be honest with you. But
wait, not executive outcomes, I hope.
No, it wasn't. But I mean, it's you spend all this time. For me, it was almost 2.5 years from when I joined to when I actually got in country, going through BUDS and SQT, and then I checked into Team 2 right as they were coming off deployment. So I had to do an 18-month workup before I deployed. So man, I was just chomping at the bit to get over there and do my part. And we get over there and we're protecting Iraqis. And it's like, well, this isn't why I signed up. And, you know, we did a couple operations, unilateral operations that really, you know, dry holes. There was just nothing there. I think I had, you know, a point in time where we were doing some counter sniper stuff, and you know, it was a little bit of action, but I, you know, I never shot my gun in my first two deployments, not once. And people don't believe me. I'm like, no, seriously, I never, not one time. So that 6 year mark after my second Iraq deployment, and you know, if you look at all the battles of Iraq, Fallujah and Habaniyah and all those places, I was there at those times and we weren't working. And I couldn't figure out why. And if we were just so mission specific, you know, what's the point? And for me, that was about 6 years in when my enlistment was coming up and it was time to either re-enlist or get out. And man, I was probably 90-10 on the get out side. And I sat down with a guy that came over from Dev Group, and you know, he was my boss at the time. And I just had the heart to heart with him and told him, you know, pretty upfront, this is how I'm feeling. I'm disappointed. And you know, he put enough thought in my head that I knew I would have regretted not screening for Dev Group. And I did. And there was never a slow moment after that. You know, that was what we were looking for. That's what I wanted to do. That's why I joined. But man, I was that close to calling it a career and getting out.
Well, that's what good leadership is, right? I mean, you know, it's, I know Rangers like to say they're triple volunteers, which is true, right? That's the reason I went to the 82nd. I chose that specifically because I was like, I want to go to the conventional army and figure out what it's all about. And I would definitely, and I want to fight, but I don't want to be around a bunch of fucking retards, right? So, or pussies, because you never know. I mean, you'd be surprised who you run into in the military, to be honest. Especially in the beginning when there were still those college tuition people. And I think that went away after a while and it's coming back now, and you can tell, right?
It's a different culture right now, for
Yeah, it is.
sure.
But you know, I just wanted to be around people who wanted to be there, because that's the right mentality. Like, yeah, it's, I don't know. There's definitely a lot of stuff, will, hand-eye coordination, athleticism, intelligence that go into whether somebody can be really good at something like that, at any physical
Agreed.
activity, right? But to be honest, if you're a relatively bright and relatively in shape person, you could turn that person into a gunfighter. It's not like rocket surgery, right? Like you can train somebody, but you got to have the stones to do it, frankly. I think that's the part that you can't train into somebody.
Yeah, I think I would agree with part of that. I think being a gunfighter, you know, point and shoot for sure, but I think being like a tactician is very different. And being smart enough to control forces and maneuver and the planning and the intel and putting it all together into a target package, it is much different than, you know, the hey, pick up that 60 and when I tell you point and shoot and you're gonna do it really well, right? So
I mean, it's the difference between somebody who spends their career in a cubicle versus a corner office, right? I mean,
Yeah,
it that really
agreed.
is what it is. So, you know, I say that to say there's a lot of very competent people at cubicle stuff in the military. You know what I mean?
Agreed.
Which is good, because you got, I mean, you can't win without that. You have to have it. But you know, when you move into the side, and you know, I guess that part of it gets overlooked a lot, just because we don't fight attrition wars anymore, so we don't think too much. Like, what does it mean to be on the front lines necessarily these days? I think our first POW in the Iraq campaign was a supply clerk, a female supply clerk, right? So it's like, or she was a truck driver. I think maybe she was a truck driver. Anyways, you know, things are a bit different, and I felt like we didn't have, or we had a lot of resources brought to us from, I guess technically they were government ops, but that a lot of other people didn't have access to, like Asymmetrical Warfare Group, for example, was put together. I only did one deployment. It was to the Surge for about 18 months or so, and so 7 and 8, 2007 and 8, we were in Sadr City, but we had AWG with us pretty much the whole time there, right? Dudes were rotating in and out. We had a Dev Guru, a commo guy and his medic. We had, I think,
I would have been there at the same time also.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We were at
Yeah.
Callahan, Cobb Callahan, just like
Wow.
800 meters west of Sauter City, I think.
Yeah.
We had those two guys. We had an old FBI dude named Bob, who was an SSE expert, and he would come on raids with us with like a fucking handgun. I'm like, you're out of your mind, dude. Dude's like 60 years old. He's
Yeah.
just like, all right, cool. And then
Good for him.
we had a couple of Ground Branch dudes as well that were there. Just like, anything we needed to know. One was a demo guy and one was just a shooter. He was a team leader.
Yeah.
And they loaned him out to us for just, for the whole time we had access like that. And it's one thing to go to training at Bragg. It's one thing to watch something or read a manual, right? Because there's a lot of Center for Army Lessons Learned has a lot of stuff you can look at too. These days there's a lot more information, but it's entirely different to go out on a raid with those guys, right? With some top level operators and see what they're doing.
Yeah.
See it applied in real time like that. I think it was a great benefit to us. And most conventional infantry units didn't have access to that stuff. I thought it would have been good for that to be the case. Now, you mentioned the dumbass mayor up there, and the defund the asinine defund the police shit. Because as
Yeah.
we all know, if you want to make something better, take all its resources away. That's fucking. It's in every go. Take an MBA class. They'll tell you immediately,
Right.
yep, take all the resources away. They'll get better. No, that's
The irony
retarded.
of the whole, cracking down on overtime, right? People get
Yeah.
upset that cops are making so much money on overtime, but the reality of that is it's cheaper to pay police overtime than it is to hire more police, because then you don't have to pay retirement, you don't have to pay pension, you don't have to pay medical, you don't have to pay all that stuff. And I think they figured out real quick once they got there that, oh, wait a second, I can't take away the overtime because then I'm gonna have to hire more people.
Yeah.
So they would rather be undermanned and overworked than, fully manned and have good morale and healthy, mentally healthy officers. It's, I
It's
don't get it.
stupid. I mean, it's
Yeah.
it, you can tell that it's run by people who have no real commitment to leadership, or they're just incompetent, which I don't know which one's
None.
worse, to be honest.
Yeah.
But the point of that is in the breach, I guess. So we had that issue in the early stages of the war as well. You mentioned not being utilized properly in your first couple of deployments. That was a pretty routine thing, to be honest. And a big part of it was that none of our non-general field grade officers at the brigade and division level had any combat experience, because we hadn't been to combat
Yeah.
since Gulf War One, and if you want to call that combat, right? There was dudes with
Yeah.
CIBs out there, but I think there's probably some dubious ones, frankly. Not to discredit their service.
Yep.
This just wasn't like it wasn't like what we experienced. It was different, and it was quick. So we didn't have any of that institutional knowledge anymore. And a lot of the planning, not having, which is interesting because Colin Powell was there, right? He was Secretary of State. And one of the guidelines we use for justifying war, Powell's three rules, right? Like public will, clear and defined, whatever the fuck, and then annihilate them with overwhelming force. Like that's his, the Powell Doctrine was still literally active at that time. But we didn't have field grade officers that knew how to apply that shit correctly. As
Yeah.
you're two fucking
We're
veterans
gonna
here.
see it again here soon too, right?
Yeah,
A lot of
yeah.
the guys that in my generation that spent two decades in combat, they're all out. They're
Yeah.
gone. They're doing different things, and yeah, and we're not. There's not a lot of combat going on anywhere right now. Maybe some advice and assist for some of the, tier one forces, but that's it. So if something else happens, we've found a way to get rid of all our talent.
This episode is brought to you by Ghostbed. Ghostbed.com/drinkingbros. Go there today and get 50% off site wide. All their mattresses, all the sheets, everything. They've got the Ghostbed Classic. They've got the Ghostbed 3D Matrix. They've got the Ghostbed Lux. And now they've got the new one, the Ghostbed Flex Hybrid. All these are cooling mattresses. They're the best in the business. They also have the new technology that we've been looking for all this time. Well, not we, just Joel. Which is the RV mattress. Now, if you've got one of these things, you know that you can't find a mattress that fits them appropriately, at least not a good one. And the ones that come with them are terrible. So if you're you know, an RV person, you definitely want to jump on that. And by the way, they got the best pillows in the business. You've heard me say it before, but I travel with these things. That's how good they are. It's kind of a pain in the ass, but not as bad as sleeping on hotel pillows, I'll tell you that much. So go to ghostbed.com/drinkerbros today. Use the code Ghost or Drinker Bros at checkout. You're going to get 50% off all the mattresses. Check them out today. We've been with them for a while. I've got them all over my house. You know they're good. So my best advice here is go for the 3D Matrix. It's the most comfortable bed I've ever slept on in my life. Go get it today. Go to ghostbed.com/drinkerbros. Use the code Drinker Bros. You're going to get 50% off. That's 50% off. You're not going to get a better deal.
Yeah, yeah. And it's like, this is actually true. And NBA will teach you this. It's 7 times cheaper to keep a customer than it is to find a new one, right?
Find a new one.
And it's the same thing with an employee. It is wildly expensive to find a mediocre employee, much less one that's operating at the top level. So for us, you know, or for the guys who deployed early in the war, they just kind of had to figure that shit out, right? We still had some institutional knowledge about urban combat from the dudes who jumped into Panama and some other stuff like that. Some Moog dudes were still around and Ranger bats and shit like that, and they had found their way into commands, but it was very thin. And it was just going through it, experiencing it, and then building institutional knowledge. And by 2.5 years into the war, asymmetrical warfare group was stood up to solve that problem, right? Now, there hasn't been any concerted effort by the Department of Justice that I'm aware of to fix the problem of low frequency training of police nationwide.
None whatsoever. Right?
And you would think that as the nation's top cops, that would be their job, right? Like if the Department of Education, which none of these departments should even fucking exist, to be honest, but if the Department of Education saw that something was wrong with teachers, they'd be like, all right, cool, maybe we need to adjust our policy about this or that. DOJ didn't have, not that they control local police or anything like that, but they are a mentor, right? You're supposed to be pushing information down so people can learn and do their jobs better. There's been none of that. So without your guys, without Community First, without police posts on Instagram, keeping people informed about different kinds of stuff, just, you know, and then Tim Kennedy's stuff, Mike Glover's stuff, without former military dudes, mostly, right? And there's some cops. I think you guys have a Boston police officer, retired superintendent on your staff, right? Without that, this problem doesn't get solved, right? Which is crazy because it's public safety. I mean, it's like rule number one. That's rule number one. If you look at Maslow's hierarchy of needs, it is number one, right? So what the
fuck? Take care of people.
Man? Like how is it possible that didn't get solved?
Well, I always say that law enforcement is great at about 99% of their job, right? Because they can train on the job and become pretty proficient. There's always going to be people that no matter how much you train them, they're not going to get any better. They're just not good at the job, right? But to man something that has 700,000 plus people, you're going to get some low performers in there as well. Where law enforcement is failing is the response to critical incidents. And I will say, you know, an active shooter, domestic terror, you know, even, you know, de-escalation where someone pulls a gun and you have to, you know, figure out what to do. But the law enforcement doesn't train under stress unless maybe you're a SWAT team or, you know, specifically a high level SWAT team. You don't have enough training to be able to handle those situations adequately. And really, the only people that do are the tier one military operations. And which is why it's so easy for us to look at it and say, hey, this is a problem. So to go to your point, why isn't law enforcement fixing it? Well, law enforcement doesn't know they have a problem in many cases, or in the senior levels, they don't think they have a problem. And their solution is, hey, let me add more training, 8 hours, 40 hours, whatever it is, and I'm gonna have other cops teach cops how to respond to these incidents, even though those cops that are teaching have never been in an incident like that. So that's what we bring to the table that is different. And that's why I'm doing podcasts and going on news and shouting from the rooftops, hey, you can't teach something you've never done and expect people to learn to a level that they need to be able to do it at. Alert. The curriculum is pretty good. There's definitely some things that should change in that curriculum, but you have people teaching alert that are qualified to teach it because they took a class on alert, not because they went to battle and were in a bunch of gunfights or as a cop, they responded to dozens of active shooter situations. It's because they got qualified in a classroom. So, that's not the problem. Officers need to work under stress. They need to be taught to handle these situations as realistic as possible. And there's only so many people in the country that are doing that right now. And, you know, we're trying to do it for free to make sure everybody gets it.
Yeah, and that's how, it's a really good explanation of the details on the ground. So
yeah.
For people who are not, like, people who haven't experienced any of this stuff, worked in a violent career field, or a potentially violent career field, I guess you could say, how is it possible that there could be a school shooting at Uvalde, 370-some police officers show up, and it takes that amount of time for somebody else to come in and interdict that situation, right?
Yeah.
Well, the reason is because these, as you say, these people have not been in gun. I mean, unless you've gone through shoot houses with Artie Sims and fucking people in blocking pads rocking you from the side and shit like that, just like real life experience at a minimum, much less actually haven't gone and gotten into real gunfights before. You have no idea what violence of action means. Like, you can't understand it until your butthole puckers up and that adrenaline goes into your brain and you get tunnel vision. And you're like, all right, cool. I got to widen my vision back again because I'm about to get fucked up, right? You have to, the only way to learn that is to experience it. And how, like, if you, I hate to put you on the spot here, but if you had to guess what percentage of police officers in the U.S. have anything closely resembling that particular type of training, what would you say it is? It can't be more than like 1%, frankly.
If you take SWAT out of the mix, and you know, a lot of SWAT teams train well, or you know, I would say the bigger city SWAT teams that have a budget train pretty good. Like LA is out there all the time, Dallas, Miami-Dade, all those bigger cities. But they're not the ones responding to these incidents, right? 94%+, I don't remember the exact number, of active shooter incidents are done by the time a SWAT team arrives. So the officer with the least amount of experience in our country is the one responding to the most critical of situations. And I would say probably, the majority of departments I run across have had no training at all. And occasionally I'll run to some bigger city ones that have an 8 to 20 hour course for active shooter that's very canned. And it's usually based on alert.
But it's like it's a PowerPoint.
It's a lot of classroom stuff, and then it's walking them through scenarios and then letting do the scenarios you just walked them through and saying, okay, check in the box. You are trained on active
shooter. I've done those before. It is like a digital shoot, no shoot. It's target discrimination. That's not how to respond to an active
shooter.
That's not the
same. You don't have the stress. It's not at all. And you know, half of the Uvalde cops had alert training. And again, I'm not shitting on alert. I think it's what they're doing is really good, and they're trying to get it out to the masses and standardize stuff. It's just hard to teach something that you don't have experience on. And that's kind of what's happening. And you can't recreate. We do that in special operations, and you touched on it earlier, that we go overseas and we get in these battles and do these things. Then we come back and we write it down and we talk about it and we change our tactics. You know, we do really good job of an after action report to change tactics and drive future operations. Police don't do that, right? When they make mistakes, they don't want to say anything because they don't want to get in trouble. They don't want to, you know, get made fun of, whatever it is. The culture of law enforcement isn't such that we're trying to change things. We just get rid of people that fuck up. And unfortunately, if you don't train, those fuck ups are going to come real world.
Yeah. And, I mean, the stakes are pretty high, right?
Yeah.
When the stakes are high, anytime there's two people and a gun is involved, right? Two people that don't know each other, especially, because I don't know what you're up to. You don't know what I'm up to. And sometimes you just find yourself in a shitty situation and there's no great answer to that situation. And that sucks, right? Now, when you're wearing when you're wearing a uniform, it's an entirely different situation because now you're a target, right? And I just, like,
unfortunately,
it's kind of wild, man. The lack of training, and we're not talking about like Ames, Iowa's police department. The NYPD's training budget is 1% of their budget. 1%? What the fuck? How is that possible?
Their budget's $1 billion, right? So it is 1%. The 90, what is the number? It's over 95% of a police department's budget goes to payroll and retirement. Medical payroll, that's it. And everything else that's left over, and it's like 99%. Everything else that's left over is then divided up. So, and think about a department like New York City, and you have 1% of their budget going, think of how many people they're putting through the academy every year. Because the training budget, most of it goes to the academy and getting new officers on the streets. So what then is left over for that, you know, continuing education? Well, you know, it's whatever's the latest, right? It's DEI. It's we got this new computer system. We got inclusion. We got all this. Like, that's what they're getting trained on. Very few officers are getting tactical training outside of a specialized unit.
1% of a billion is 10 million, right? And there's 35,000.
It's a lot of money. Yeah.
10 million is a lot of money, but there's 35,000 sworn officers on the NYPD. That's, you guessed it, $285.71.
Yeah.
Per officer for training annually. How is that possible? I mean, that can't be right.
I think New York is very much a, and again, I have to be very careful, right? I do not want to criticize police officers, because I think I am so grateful that there's still people willing to put themselves in those positions to protect me, protect my family and our communities. And it's, again, not their choice. They are subject to this, just like we are in the military. And, you know, we're always bitching about what we do in the military and how we make it better. So I'm very critical of the policies and the departments, but I'm very supportive, overwhelmingly supportive of the officers. And I will say, in New York, they hire a lot of officers. And if you go there, they're on every street. And it's more of a show of force than it is having people who could respond to these situations, right? It's just, yep, we got a body here, we got a body here, we got a body here. And yeah, we've got a lot of officers on the department. But how many of them are actually, whatever you want to call it, skill positions where they have that tactical training and the ability to respond to something when it does happen?
So the average McDonald's employee, $2,500 a year is spent on them to train them per year, even after they've worked there for a while. They have continuing education and shit at McDonald's.
Have you seen the stat? And I think it's Tennessee, where exponentially it takes more hours to become a hairdresser than it does a police officer.
Oh yeah, it has to. Well, I mean, maybe in New York as well. If they're only spending $300, you can't train anybody for $300 a person.
No,
that's ridiculous. No.
Yeah, and you know, we're throwing out numbers, but I'm not sitting here looking at the budget, so I know it's significant, the overall budget. And they have a lot of officers. So, yeah, I don't know. And this isn't just New York. It isn't just big cities. It's every department across the country. Uvalde is the standard right now. The level of training Uvalde has, that is the standard across the country. We got lucky in the national one because we had some prior military guys respond, and they were aggressive, right? They weren't tactically very sound, and it could have gone badly. There was a lot of buddy sweeps, a couple potential blue-on-blues. You know, they only hit that person four times, and they must have shot over a dozen. So where are those rounds going, right? And they're inside of like 20 feet with a rifle.
On the second floor shooting through glass, right? So it could go wrong.
Yeah. So, you know, just because it was successful doesn't mean it can't improve. And people, I'm surprised that people are not screaming from the rooftops to get cops more training, especially when we're sending hundreds of billions of dollars overseas to help other countries, when we could take a fraction of that and resolve some of these issues pretty instantly.
Yeah, I kind of feel like you either have to secure your border or your cities.
That would help too, yeah.
Preferably both, right? I mean, a normal human being would want to do both, but you can't not do both. You have to do at least one of the fucking things, right? Jesus.
Yeah. You know, what would happen right now in the U.S. if we had an Israeli-style attack?
Well, I mean,
who's going to stop it?
If we can't marshal the temerity and have the proper training and experience to take one person down who's shooting up a bunch of kids, what's somebody? What are one of those? You know what I mean? And look, I'm with you. I don't like don't hate the player, hate the game. Right? Like, cops are fucked right now. They're fucked in every way. They can't. They're paying for their own rounds. Right. They get their department, most places, right? They get their department issue ammo, and then they get two training events a year, something like that, to qualify. And
yeah, if that, if
every,
that. Every the average is 12 to 15 hours a year of shooting. Mm-hmm. And what's real behind that is, if you go to your range, because they have to get through all the numbers, a lot of these big cities, you go to the range and you pass your qual on the first shoot, then you're done. You know, because they train to pass a qual, they don't train to be in a tactical situation. And again, that's not SWAT teams, that's patrol officers.
But if you and I were on a deployment right now, like a fucking 4 to 6 month long deployment, and we were doing raids all every night this week, we would still get together during the day and put some engineer tape on the ground or something, right?
Yeah.
And just sharpen up a little bit. Like, hey, remember, guys, let's run through this right quick, make sure we got everything. Anybody got any notes? All right, cool. Look, we're out of here.
Right.
Like that doesn't.
And we would have done a 12 month workup.
Yeah.
To prepare for that deployment.
Yeah. Like an ITC and then a workup after. I mean, it's like
all that. Yeah. Professional development, group training. We would have had prepared completely before we went out to the door. And law enforcement has the academy, which they have, depending on the academy, very fundamental firearms and tactical lesson plans. And then they have 40 hours of in-service on average per department. So 40 hours a year of in-service training is what they get. And then we want to throw them in jail or arrest them or fire them when they fail. I mean, they're going to keep failing because they don't know better. And you put them in these high stress situations, well, they're going to revert to what they've been taught, and that's pull your gun. Mm. You know, because they are, you don't have to prove to me that they're afraid for their life. They are. They don't know what's going to happen because they've never been in that situation. It's no different than taking somebody off the street and giving them a gun and sending them into a building and telling them, don't shoot the wrong person. Mm. They're going to be terrified.
Yeah, I mean, you can look on YouTube and find videos. It was after some of the original, like the OG BLM protests back in maybe 2014 or something like that. And a bunch of, not a bunch, but a couple of, they call themselves journalists, I think, went to an outdoor urban range, right? It's like, all right, cool. We're going to run you through some of our drills here and you see if you can survive. Like, nope, they killed the wrong people every time or they got shot in the face every single time. It's like, yeah,
it's hard.
It's not that easy without the appropriate training, right? And it's like shooting pieces of paper is not the appropriate training.
No, you need you know, paint rounds and real feedback. People actually making decisions whether or not that you need to respond to with force. And, you know, what I'm teaching is a natural de-escalation tactic as well, right? If you give guys the better ability to read situations and make decisions accordingly, then you are naturally de-escalating situations because they don't feel like they have to jump right to the gun right off the bat. Like we're raising the threshold between when they are redlined and decide they're going to have to shoot, right? We're giving them more time to make, even if it's a couple seconds, to make decisions. And sometimes that decision could be the difference between saving a life and taking a life. But for what they have right now in training, it's hard for me to get mad at an officer for shooting when you don't give them any other options to handle the situation.
Yeah, it's if the individual officer is more confident in that situation, which means they are tactically trained well, right? And they know they can do whatever it is they need to do.
Yeah.
If they're in better shape, have better hand-to-hand skills, right?
Yeah.
Then this is just like having good vision and bat speed if you're a baseball player. You can wait longer. Sure. You can wait longer to make a decision on whether or not you're going to swing now, right? Well, now you get to wait longer on a decision that might cost somebody their life. And you're going to make a better decision in the end because you have more data and you let your brain go through that process.
Yeah. You know, you teach an officer distance and angles, right? Most officers don't understand that. Tactical. Even a lot of the tactical officers don't understand that. But now I just gave myself the tactical advantage against this person. And even if they do have a gun in their hands, I don't necessarily need to shoot because I put myself in a position where if that gun levels, I have time to make the decision to shoot. And certainly I'm not telling officers to shoot or not to shoot, right? That's an individual decision based on departmental ROEs and whatnot. But what I am saying is there's things you can do on the tactical side that buy you more decision-making time. And that's what we're doing. We're solving problems on the fly under stress. And we're trying to help them do that better.
And those aren't like, not rocket science there. This is like creating distance and angles and cutting off and then doing the inverse of that, cutting off corners and shit. That's basic UFC. Like you learn that immediately if you're a striker.
Yeah.
like, right, or like if you're a boxer, shit. Or
any, talk
or
of war, right?
Yeah, like yeah. you immediately learn to either create, well, to do both, to create distance if you need to, if a guy's got reach yeah. on you, or to close distance, right? Like you learn how to do that, or to keep a guy from skirting alongside of you. And then, you know, another part of it, a big part of that is pre-fight indicators. And to be honest, that one is, to me, that's like, I think of an old dude who's just got experience. You yeah. know what I mean? Somebody that's just been in that spot a bunch of times, or like, that dude's about to do something dumb right there. You can tell. Yep. Look at his fists yep. are clenched. You know, his fucking knuckles are white. He's sweating for no reason. Yep. Like, that dude's about to fucking fight somebody for no reason. Yeah. It's like, how do you teach people to be able to recognize that without putting them under extreme stress, you know?
Yeah, you know, they have to fail, right? A lot, everything I learned in my career on tactics, and you know, I've done it a lot, is based on every time I failed. And I was fortunate enough that the majority of the times that I failed, it was in training. And I was, for that reason, we were very successful on real world operations. And, you know, you look at our command and some of the other tier one commands, we still fail. With all the training and all the preparation and all the AARs that we do, we still fail. And now we're asking some of the least trained people who carry weapons as their job to respond to these situations that, you know, tier one operators potentially could fail at. So, yeah, it's tough. And having that wisdom and having that experience, which is why we're teaching it, we're sharing the knowledge, is because we are those guys. Those guys have done it a million times. And I can often tell you what the guy's going to do just based on the mannerisms and how they're acting. You know, I can tell you if they're going to escalate, they're going to de-escalate. I'll tell you if they're going to maneuver or not. It's just, you learn to read that pretty quickly once you do it enough. And unfortunately, we aren't allowing our police officers to get that experience.
Do you think it's just like bureaucratic incompetence or what? I mean, I know that we have a finite amount of money, I guess, but we spend it on a lot of stupid shit. I never believe that when somebody says we don't, you can't tell me we don't have the money to fix our cities when we can fix other people's cities, right?
Yeah, I agree. The money's there. We can find the money. And you know, the state of Massachusetts has given me money, you know, as liberal as it is, they've accepted us. They've given us a line item on the budget. But the majority of what I've raised up to now has come through private donorship. You know, people like you and I who see a problem and want to help because it affects them, it affects their communities, affects their children in school, right? And their safety. So at the end of the day, though, the problem is so big and extensive that private donorship can't fund this. There needs to be governmental input to fix the problem. And we send billions of dollars overseas to fix other people's problems when we could, you know, we could significantly impact this. And, you know, my kind of wazoo idea about that is if you look at how the military trains, specifically special operations, you know, we talked about it already. We train for 12 months to do a 4-month deployment. We train for 18 months to do a 6-month deployment. Law enforcement works for 12 months and trains 40 hours. So that's a big problem right there that we need to address. Well, what if we hired more officers that we could put them on a rotation where they work 3 weeks and they're off 1 week, and that 1 week where they're off, they train? Like, that's something money could fix.
Sure, yeah.
Now, I don't know if officers would want that, right? You know, and you're going to have people pushing back. But at the end of the day, if we really want to prioritize public safety, then let's figure out a way to bring the level of competency up in law enforcement. And that doesn't mean we have to do a week of tactical training every month. But man, think of how good our police would be with an extra week every month of training.
Yeah, and it's not just, I mean, obviously that's a big part of it, the training part. But there are other logistical issues with that I'm not entirely sure how to solve. Like a dude having to do a bunch of fucking paperwork after a long shift. Like, all right, man, we're not setting the, like, I filled out plenty of 15-6s after raids because we shot up a bunch of shit. It's happened, yeah. Right? You got to do the paperwork, I guess. But it's different. It's a little bit different in the military, I think. You're just writing shit down on a piece of paper and then you can go to sleep. Spending like fucking 4-6 hours after your shift trying to get some dude booked and writing reports and stuff. Fuck that. I mean, it that's the job though, right? You got to do it. And there's only one way to solve that. Unless you're going to let AI write the reports, hiring and training more officers is the only solution to that, right? Like, there's no other way to do that.
Yeah.
That I can no other way that I can tell other than just throwing more bodies at it.
Yeah. No, I would agree. I would think that technology is probably going to be coming along that would make it easier at some point, if not already. But, you know, officers work overtime because they need the money and they have a quality of life that they want to maintain. And if they work 60 hours a week, they do that. But they don't get training, right? So then you're asking them to go train outside of work and on top of all the administrative stuff they got to do. And these people want to see their families and their kids. And, you know, you want to maintain your lifestyle, but you're doing it by, you know, choosing between family time or training on my own time. I want to go to the range right now? Do I want to go roll? I want to go to my kid's soccer game. Mm. So, you know, how do we pay officers the quality at the quality of life that they're at right now without having to spend their entire life doing what they need to do to be proficient? And, you know, they'd never have a family life. The morale would be so low. Mm. It becomes a mental health issue, which we're already seeing. Mental health in law enforcement is where we were probably 10 years ago.
Yeah, it's getting rough. I mean, just hearing from friends that are in the industry, you know. Fire figured it out.
They did. And we talk about
the situation is not that different, frankly. It's not that different. And fire does quite a bit more training than police do. And look, the stakes, you could say they're equally high, I guess, depending on the day. I think it's probably a little bit more dangerous to be a cop just because you're always out there, right? That's just a numbers game, right?
Yeah. And nobody gets upset when a fireman shows up. Everybody's happy to see a fireman.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people out there, they hate police. They're spitting at police, throwing things at police. It's the quality of life is way different. And you see these towns like Boston, New York, Chicago, all these generational towns where they're a cop because their dad was a cop or their mom was a cop and so on, and grandfather. And now they're going in the fire department because they love the job, they love the pay, they love the lifestyle and the flexibility. They just don't want all the hate that they're getting from policing now. And it just felt it affects the output, you know, the quality of the officer when you have these people that are choosing another career.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the same thing is going on in the military, by the way. People,
absolutely.
A lot of folks from different organizations, including the DOD, have asked me about they call it the recruiting crisis. I'm like, it's not a recruiting crisis, right? You have a marketing, you have a marketing crisis, not a recruiting crisis, because people like you and me normally would have walked our 18-year-old son into the recruiting station and made that motherfucker sign up. And now we're like, I wouldn't sign up right now. So I'm definitely not going to send my kid out there. Right. And it's, I would say it might be worse for police right now, because you're seeing from New York, from San Francisco, a couple other places around the country, you're seeing mass exoduses, people leaving their cities or leaving policing altogether because they're just tired of this bullshit. That's not good, man. I mean, it's just like that is a very, very bad thing, because you're losing current cops, you're losing legacy cops that will come after them, and the institutional knowledge that they took out of the system with them. It's like that is a very fucking bad situation.
And we're hiring based on DEI, not merit, right? So the quality of officer potentially is going down. And same thing in the military. It's like, hey, we want the best warfighters out there because that's what we do, right? Mm-hmm. But apparently that's not the case. So, I don't know. I don't know how you fix it. I know the direction we're going now isn't right. And I hope we can figure that out as a country and unite and right the ship. So before it's too far along to correct.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. So you mentioned mental health stuff. Do you guys, that is a huge problem for police and fire and I think EMS actually might be the worst, to be honest. They see more fucked up shit than anybody. But for just on the police side, do you guys do anything in that regard or?
We do, and it kind of came about just randomly. So I started this with an Army, Tier 1 Army guy as well. He's since moved on to other things. But we both had gunshot wounds, very similar ones from deployments. And an officer in one of the communities we had trained had a similar injury happen right after we had trained them. And they asked us to speak with them. And we did, and we found out just that that peer mediation stepping in and talking about the injury and talking about how we were able to recover and mentally recover as well as physically and move on and get back on the horse helped out quite a bit. And it kind of gave me the idea that, you know, obviously two decades of combat, we've had a lot of guys injured. And law enforcement is now seeing it, I think, at a higher rate where they're having either guys injured or officers that are taking shots and having to kill people, because that is not normal in policing. You know, most officers will never shoot their gun. So how we help is we provide SEALs and Army Special Operations personnel who have been in similar situations. We just connect them for some peer mediation. It's just guidance. It's not clinical by any means. It's just a shoulder to lean on and say, hey, I went through this however many years ago. This is how I came out the other side successfully. What can I do to help? And it doesn't cost me anything on the nonprofit side to do that. It just, it's just networking and putting the right people together seems to help. And we've actually gotten a lot of people reaching out to us for that, which is great.
Spring is in the air at Littleton Coin Company, and we want to help you brighten your collection. Visit us at littletoncoin.com all month long to enjoy 15% off your purchase. With a wide selection of coins, paper money, supplies, and more, Littleton Coin Company has something for every collector's taste. Use promo code SPRING at littletoncoin.com for 15% off your purchase all month long. Restrictions apply. Littleton Coin Company, serving collectors since 1945.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Yeah, that is good. I just got back from a speaking event with some people about this for military folk, and it's pretty much the same. I mean, more cops die from suicide than in the line of duty, right?
Yeah.
And that, including, like, stress-related stuff, right? So more cops are still dying from suicide. I think in the military vet community, it's four times more have killed themselves than have died in combat. So we're looking at some pretty similar circumstances. And I remember, I mean, it's still bad. It's actually getting worse for the military right now. And I don't know about the broader veteran community is trending upward a little bit, but active duty people are making up 36% of suicides now. And about a third of them have never deployed before, almost 40% actually have never deployed. So it's not combat stress anymore, right? We got some fucking problems with you can call that morale. I think that's underselling it a little bit. We've got some problems with identity, you know what I mean? People that don't
understand. If it doesn't have to do with the recruiting and who we're recruiting
for sure.
And how that's changed. So
it must because it's never been like this before. Typically speaking, in the years following a major combat operation like World War I, World War II, Korea, Vietnam, so on and so forth. During the war, suicides are low. After the war, suicides are high. Now, it doesn't help that we stayed at war for 20 fucking years, I guess, but we experienced them both at the same time. So I think about policing right now and how fucked up it is. And I think about, like, we're not exactly at a peak now, but most of the people that served when we served, are either getting help or have made it through by now. So it's like, I remember the valley, you know what I mean? It was not great.
Like
friends dying on a pretty like a monthly basis. Basically somebody was fucking blowing their fucking brains out. And we can't afford that shit, man. We can't afford any more damage to police morale. We definitely can't afford to lose trained seasoned officers at this point.
No.
So it's like,
we're at red line, right? It's critical levels right now. And, you know, we need more people to step up and start speaking out against some of the stuff that's happening. And that's why I'm doing this. You know, certainly I could have done this on the for-profit side and probably made a lot more money, but the people I would be training would not be these police officers. It would be government. It would be military. It would be foreign countries. It would be things like that. So it's they need our help. And if we're not willing to step up and do it, then there's not many people out there that can do it for them.
So tell me about the organization. What is it exactly? What do you offer? Right.
So and explain, Community First brought,
yeah, sorry, go ahead. At first, explain the process by which a cop could get their police department to get in touch with you guys and start that process as well. And then what you guys do.
So Community First Project, c1p.org. We easily Community First is obviously what we're prioritizing, community safety. And we provide no cost training to law enforcement to help combat critical incidents like active shooter, domestic terror. Any department can reach out to me on my website. You can email me direct through the website and we'll just jump on a phone call and we'll talk. At the end of the day, I am limited by the amount of money I have. It's an expensive thing to be able to provide this training. So I have had a hard time providing training outside of the states that I've already been fundraising in. But if we have the ability to fundraise in your area and there's departments that want to do it in your area, then we'll be on board. We will literally do whatever we can to try and make it work. And that's the goal, is to take this nationally. Most of what we've done now has been up in New England, but I just got back from Texas, Florida last month, Connecticut, New York, California. So we're starting the process to raise money in those places as well until we actually get federal money to be able to sustain us a lot longer. A little bit about the organization. I retired in 2020 and I got out and I started the for-profit company. Even though I intended on training patrol officers, I wanted to do it on the for-profit side. And I realized within the first couple months that there isn't a department out there that could afford me. So I was doing the for-profit stuff, training military, training federal agencies. And then I was just on my own time going and providing free training to these departments. Mostly people that I knew and had worked with throughout my career. So that's where the idea for the nonprofit came. And we started in January of 22. The first 6 months was really just putting the business plan together. And I took my business plan and I sent it to every Democrat politician that I could get my hands on, because I want this to be nonpartisan. I want to help everybody. And I don't want a political figure to stand in the way and say, oh, no, we don't want this. I want to get ahead of that. And to be completely honest, I've got more support financially from Democratic politicians than Republicans. So I got that feedback, and 6 months, August of 22, we actually launched and first training and fundraising. And our first fundraiser, we raised over $300,000, and we're close to $750,000 raised now and about 1,000 officers trained. And we're just going strong. Unfortunately for me, we took off so quickly that I don't get to do the training anymore. So I've become like the business development / fundraiser. And that's fine. Somebody's got to do it. And I'm the one that started this, and I'm the one that's so passionate about it. And not that the other guys aren't, but I will do that. And then it allows me to hire veterans. So all my trainers are tier one operators from Army or Navy. And they usually it's the year or so from when they get out to when they find their next career that I'm able to employ them. And they get a paycheck, and they get to go out and share this knowledge with the people that really need it. So it's win on a couple fronts. It's a win on the employing veterans and giving them a purpose. And it's a win on providing training that is critical to community safety, to the departments that really, really need it. And that's it, man. And I'm doing podcasts and doing news. I'm doing whatever I can to get the word out there, to get support, to get the messaging out there. Not just that we need help, but that the police world needs change. They need change in how they train. And people need to be aware of the deficiencies so they can start asking for change.
Yeah. It's interesting the way that you're cycling guys through like that, because that is sort of how that's how the Army and Marine Corps did basic training during Vietnam. If you were an NCO of a 5 or 6 from a line unit, and part of your rotation back was to go to basic training and train dudes up for a little bit, right? Like, here's what I just learned from being over there. Makes sense, right? That somebody just did it instead of because there's a lot. I haven't been in a gunfight since 2008. So what the fuck do I know, right? At this point,
yeah. To be honest, tactics change, right?
Yeah, everything changes. But you know, institutional knowledge grows, it makes way more sense to have somebody coming right off the line do that stuff.
You know, it I don't have the money right now to pay guys to make this a career. Right. So, but I can pay them a contract here, a contract there, and get them that little extra money that on top of their retirement, you know, improves their quality of life. But the goal certainly is as we get going and as we start raising the money to levels that we can start hiring out, that when a guy retires from the military and goes back to their home state, then I can hire them to be my program manager in that state. And they're basically doing my job locally. So, you know, and they move back to Dallas. And now I have a full-time employee in Dallas whose only job is to set up training and hire people to do it and to liaise with the donors and to liaise with the police departments. And honestly, a lot of guys are doing this anyway because they want the departments and the places they live to be the best that they can. Mm-hmm. And I'm just found out a way to offer them a paycheck to do it.
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of how Tim started training cops, just training the ones up in Cedar Park where he lives. If someone said to you or asked you the question, the training looks good, everything looks good, but it's kind of a one and done situation. So what do we do once you're gone? How is that programmatically addressed for you guys? I'm sure there's train the trainer
or
something like that.
So yeah, you know, yes and no, not yet. And I'll be, everybody I work with, I'll be the first to tell them that 40 hours is not enough. I won't do less than 40 hours. I've had departments ask me for a 2-day course. I won't do that. It's you can do the full week or not at all, because I, you know, 2-day course isn't going to do shit, to be completely honest. A 40-hour course really identifies more problems than it fixes. But that's what we want. We want to identify the shortfalls in training so then they can turn around and build something out that fixes it. And we want to be there along the way to help them do that. So, you know, I tell everybody this is relational, not transactional. And when you use us to train, we try to do it at no cost. And we've been pretty successful with that so far. But when we leave, we are your point of contact. We will come back. We will help you. We will, you know, we'll audit what you're doing now on training to make sure that you're able to implement some of the things that we provided. And when you have questions, you can call me. And if I don't have the answers, one of my guys will have the answers. Like, we will find it for you. And that's the goal. The goal is to be the one-stop shop for any department that needs help. And it isn't a one and done. It will never be a one and done. We don't want that. We want relationships.
And hopefully to affect policy at some point, right? Like, that's whenever you're doing something like this, that's going to be a needle mover. You hope that it becomes successful and ubiquitously used enough that people are like, all right, well, we definitely should be doing this everywhere, because it becomes a liability issue. If town A is doing it, town B isn't, right? Town B is kind of liable for not taking advantage of that shit.
Yeah, honestly, what we're teaching right now is just fundamentals. There's nothing secretive to it, but we have a bunch of guys that know why these fundamentals exist. And it should be taught in the academies. We should be teaching academy students going through becoming officers, and then we can focus on more advanced stuff once they get into the departments. Unfortunately, we have all these officers, 700,000 plus now, that have never had this type of training, that we're trying to get it and get it backfilled, so to speak. So, yeah, it's a hard job. And we have to affect policy. We have to affect budget. We have to get money to put into this program. And, you know, there's only so many SEALs and Delta guys out there that can do this. So at some point, we have to train the trainer. Mm-hmm. We have to bring in other levels of special operations to be able to provide this training. And eventually getting these SWAT teams up to par with our guys so that they can teach it organically within their departments.
Sweet. Well, that's a pretty good pitch.
Yeah. We're trying, man. We're trying.
Well, look, we appreciate it. It's, you know, it's easy to be critical. It's easy to armchair quarterback. Right. It's another thing altogether to fucking do something. So,
I agree.
Yeah, we appreciate you guys doing that shit, because, you know, I personally, I don't depend on police, because, you know, it's just a ping issue, right? Like, I'm there already, so I don't need to do that. But like,
for most people are not in that boat.
For the vast majority of people, man, like, if you, believe me when I tell you, one, don't, I say this all the time, don't try to get in a fucking knife fight with somebody. That's retarded. You're going to die.
Yeah.
You're going to get cut at least, which sucks. Just run away. If you got to run away. Who cares?
Yeah. Right.
But like, this isn't the movies, man. And that takes on two parts. One, it isn't, You're not going to fucking go to the range a couple times and shoot paper and then be able to defend your home the way you think you are, right? And that, when I say that, I'm not telling you not to be ready to defend it. I'm telling you to go get ready to fucking defend it, right? That's the first part. The second part is, you know, there's some asshole cops out there. The ones that make the shoot, no shoot situations, I don't get jazzed up about that much because, you know, that's like, I've been in those situations. You don't want to be critical of that guy, you know, because you're going to rise and fall to the level of training, and that's not always up to you and police.
Correct.
But it also isn't true that you fucking slide over the hood of your car, fire one round, and the dude just is incapacitated. So, like, there's a video circulating on Twitter right now of this pedophile that was showing up to meet a 7 and a 11 year old or something. And the guy pulls out a gun and they just smoke. He's like, oh, how would they have to shoot him so many times for? We're like, what the fuck are you talking about?
Yeah.
What? Because that's how many rounds they had? I don't know.
Like, yeah. The human body can take a lot. And I don't think people realize that. You know, just because you take a bullet doesn't mean you're done. I've seen people take dozens of bullets and still get up. I've seen a guy with his brains hanging out of his head sit up. So you shoot them till they stop moving.
Yep.
And that's it. And if you have the wherewithal to take one shot, you have the wherewithal to take more than one shot, right? Yep. The guy deserves it at that point. Mm-hmm. So, I agree with you.
And you know, just
public opinion.
It is. And like, I know the optics can look bad sometimes. Just make sure that, you know, make sure you understand that, like, what exactly, I don't know. I don't want to be preachy about it. Just like,
well, when you have a president situation. When you have a president encouraging officers to shoot to wound, right? You clearly have no idea what's going on in this country at that point, right? Because you even talked about it earlier. You get the tunnel vision, you lose dexterity. And when you're in these critical incidents, you can't take a shot. You ain't center mass. That is what you do, especially someone like an officer in most cases has never been in a gunfight.
Yeah.
But now you have half the country that hears the president say, well, why aren't they shooting them in the leg? And you know what? If he had taken the time to talk to anybody on a tactical team, even his own Secret Service people, they could have answered that question for him instantly. But he goes on the record saying that, and half the country believes it. It adds to criticism.
Yeah, it's retarded, man. Yeah. And this is, by the way, this is a pretty easy math problem. So most handguns are a 6 minute of angle weapon, right? It's a problem of physics, right? Which means for every certain distance, 1.047 margin of error inches, right? So at 100 meters, one inch potential on either side at 100 meters. Now I think the average that would be a 1 MOA weapon. So you're 6x that. So even at 30 feet, 10 meters, right?
Yeah.
Most gunfights happen within 9 meters, but let's say 10 for round number 6.
Sure.
You're shooting at the average width of an adult male, which is usually who it is 19 inches, I think, inside the shoulders, right? So the center mass below the fucking arm is 19 inches. That means you've got a very, very small margin of error, even shooting center mass. That's not if a guy with a handgun, if a guy's blading his body, if he's behind cover, if he's moving somewhere, it's like, if you like, this isn't the fucking movies, man. You're not shooting people in the legs.
Nope.
Right.
Not at all.
If I go up on a guy and I'm shooting him through the chest and he's not going down, then I'm going to shoot his hips out so he'll fall down. But I'm not I'm not starting at the legs and working up. That's crazy. Unless I got a saw. Maybe if I got a saw. We'll see.
Yeah. Right.
But it's just,
but officers aren't carrying saws, right?
Yeah.
And,
no,
and it sucks. They're carrying pistols. Yeah. You know, and it's, there's such a public opinion one side on rifles, but in reality, it would be much more efficient and safer for them to be carrying rifles and pistols. But we don't look at it that way because it's a big, scary military gun.
Yeah, I mean, that part of it, I don't like, I've had debates with a lot of cops about this too.
For critical incident response.
Yeah. For a critical incident, it makes sense. Yeah. Like, Bearcats and things like that. Although I don't think a Bearcat can be used as an offensive weapon unless you drive it through the front of somebody's fucking house, maybe.
Yeah.
It's, I don't know. If you go to an airport, if you fly into Fiumicino into Rome, Italy, there's dudes walking around with MP5s.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And they don't
not the best weapon, though.
It's a terrible weapon. It's a terrible weapon. Well, I mean, if you're.
It's a 9mm, right?
If you're from here to the wall, it's fine, but, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know. But anyways, yeah. But, so a lot of this is just a lack of education for people.
Right? It is.
Like, they get excited about this issue because somebody dies. All this political and social shit gets mapped onto that incident, whether it's correct or not, it doesn't matter. But then, like, step back a little bit. Did I take into consideration any of the factors from the side of the officer at all, the level of training or the circumstance or the physics that I just described that make shooting for the fucking arm or leg a retarded way to go about life? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, did you take into consideration any of this stuff? Most people don't, unfortunately.
And, you know, as much as most people don't like the body cameras, it's actually helping the officers a lot in these critical incidents.
I would bet, I don't know if anybody's done data on this, but I bet more cops have been exonerated over body cam footage than shit canned over it. Yeah. I bet it's like 20 times more, right?
Yeah, but I mean, there's still officers out there, and you know, obviously I won't name names, but there's officers out there that don't want to respond to incidents because of the body camera. And, you know, or, you know, officers, you know, rather than back somebody up, they'll stand off to the side and not help because they don't want to have to turn that. And I'm not talking about a critical incident. I'm talking about just, you know, basic stuff that maybe turns into a use of force of some sort because they don't want to be on record doing that. It's a cultural thing where officers are passive because they're afraid of prosecution for doing their job and not being provided a, you know, the tools to do their job in a way that's going to keep them out of trouble.
Yeah, well, we've definitely set them up for failure.
100%.
But luckily, you know, there's some groups out there trying to fix that problem. Yours is one of them. C1P.org.
Correct.
You guys go there, check it out. If you're a cop, fucking reach out and get some updated training. If you're able, give them some money because none of this shit happens without money.
Absolutely.
Look, we appreciate you coming today. It's been a great conversation.
Yeah, I appreciate you having me. Reach out anytime.
Yes, sir. Same to you, man. And thank you all for listening. This has been Citizen.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.